Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 22 years of law enforcement experience, 18 of which as a law enforcement analyst. She's one of the founding members of the Mid-America Regional Crime Analysis Network, also known as MARCAN. She's an author, instructor, mentor, international consultant, and curriculum developer. Whew. She is number three on my top 10 most influential people to the IACA. She went from a crime analyst in a small town in Kansas to a director with LexisNexis in Washington, D.C. Please welcome the one and only Susan Whitford. Susan, how are we doing?
Great, Jason. Thanks for having me on as a guest.
So good to hear that voice. It's so distinct, and it's good to have you on this show.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I want to just go way back and talk about how you got started in law enforcement and how you discovered law enforcement analysis.
Great question. So back in the early 90s, I worked for Overland Park, Kansas Police Department. It's a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri. And I had graduated college and just was trying to get into the field. I didn't know anything about crime analysis at that time, but I had started out as a dispatcher. And then I moved to working in records, doing call-in reports from citizens, and some time in the property room, disposing of and logging, categorizing evidence. Eventually found myself working in the station office, taking walk-in reports from citizens about car break-ins or thefts, pretty simple reports. They put me through part of the police academy, so I knew how to do the reports properly and whatnot. And as I was taking those, I started noticing, I'd be like, that's the same kind of break into a car as the report I took yesterday. They use the same way to get in. I didn't know all the terminology, what would later become crime analysis or law enforcement analysis terminology, but I did notice that there were patterns. And I knew that we had just established a new crime analysis unit and that the leader of that unit, manager, was Gary Tallman, who went on, obviously, to have been mentioned several times by you in your previous podcast as someone that's been influential. So I would take those reports upstairs to Gary and just say, hey, here's another one of those car break-ins. They did the same thing, targeting the same items, and point them out to him. And the more he encouraged that, the more I kept looking for patterns. When he got permission to hire a second crime analyst, he actually contacted me and said, I think you've got a knack for this. And so I put in my application and I was hired. I was super excited about the opportunity, something in law enforcement. I wasn't interested in becoming an officer, but this was as close to like investigating cases and linking them and looking at suspects as I'd ever come. So that's how I got my start back in 1996 into 1997 is when I really kicked off.
I hear that a lot, that this wasn't something that I seeked out, but analysis found me.
Yeah, definitely that was the case. I didn't even know what I was doing. I just knew that I liked it.
So then when you become an analyst, then what are the types of tasks that you're doing in the beginning?
Well, this, of course, was back in the 90s, and it's changed so much as to what the analysts are doing today. Back then, you know, we were literally receiving Xerox copies of police reports that fit certain kinds of criteria. So Gary had set up with the records unit and with the police officers and supervisors to notify and send a copy of their printed report, their sometimes handwritten report back then, to us. And we literally made piles of car break-ins and car thefts and residential burglaries, robberies. And we would use Excel, believe it or not, to kind of make tables and capture what later we determined to be MO information, victimology information, target locations, and whatnot. So this, when I did it, a lot of it was so manual, you know, receiving the reports, figuring out what the MO factors were, where to put them in my Excel spreadsheet, when to start looking at an emerging pattern, and what is that pattern saying? We didn't have any real formal training. It was a combination of, I guess, almost instinct or kind of a knack for it, along with even officers saying, hey, I've taken three of these that are similar. So sometimes it was the officers that pointed out an emerging trend that they were seeing. And then we could look across all the reports and sometimes contact outside agencies if it was happening along a jurisdictional border to ask them, are you also having them? But that was literally, you know, we called it phone a friend. You called who you knew at another agency. And I spent a lot of my time doing that and making crime bulletins, the weekly property crime bulletin, the weekly person's crime bulletin, stolen auto hot sheet. So I did spend a lot of time doing things. But again, this was so early in the profession before training was available, the data was available electronically, and people, analysts could do what they do today, which has the same core, but really shows itself, presents itself very differently for today's analysts.
Yeah. So you mentioned phone a friend. So at this time, how are you establishing your contacts? Because this is, as you said, before a lot of training, before a lot of the associations are established.
I started off because I didn't know people in the surrounding agencies. And again, Overland Park's a large agency. I mean, it's the second largest city in the state of Kansas behind Wichita. So it's a sizable agency and an influential agency. But the detectives already had established monthly meetings with other detectives from the jurisdictions around us, like Leawood and Lenexa and Kansas City, Missouri, and Raytown, Independence, Missouri. And so one thing I did was started going with the detectives, with their permission, to these meetings and meeting other detectives. And then we would find out about the crimes they were sharing. So for example, there was a monthly construction crimes meeting that met in Kansas City, Missouri. And so I would go with our construction crimes detective, and I would mostly sit there quietly and just kind of gather information and start kind of like hunting for patterns. And then I would tell them, hey, Leawood, guess what? Lenexa's had two of those. Shawnee's had one. Olathe's had three. And Raytown has four. Would you like me to try to bring that information together? So the detectives started seeing a role for us in supporting them. I started networking first really through detectives. Many of these agencies at that time did not have crime analysts. And they did not have anyone acting in that capacity. Even the detectives were, by default, crime analysts. As they got crime analysts and they could see I was there, other detectives started bringing their analysts. And we started our network, which later became the Mid-America Regional Crime Analysis Network, MARCAN, that you mentioned earlier. MARCAN was founded just about 3 years after I started as a crime analyst, and now is one of the largest regional associations in the United States. Very active group.
A lot of people ask, how do I get buy-in? Especially when they're new analysts, especially if they're new analysts in a new position. How they get buy-in from other investigators, police officers? But in what you just described there is you were offering a service to help them. And that was the buy-in. Is that correct?
In that case, it definitely was. I will tell you, Jason, something I have observed across the nations with large, mid-size, and even small agencies is agencies have a personality. And so there's really not going to be one secret ingredient that all analysts must have to get that buy-in. I've seen analysts that get that buy-in by befriending people. I see analysts that just have a personality that is magnetic and people want to gravitate toward them. I've seen analysts that have established themselves as, you know, an authority and, you know, gain that respect from the officers, the detectives, and the other agencies. Getting buy-in is no small task. It is a challenge. I personally faced that challenge when I left Overland Park after 12 years and went to a smaller agency, Shawnee. In the early 2000s, I went to Shawnee Police Department, which had about 90 officers, much smaller. And so here I was, a civilian, a female, with a master's degree, coming into a small, very tight-knit agency. They were very skeptic about who is she to tell us we should patrol here or that the next crime is going to happen there. What does she know about our jurisdiction? She doesn't, you know, patrol with us. She hasn't walked the walk. She hasn't chased the criminal. And those are valid concerns. And it took me a while to really, it took me maybe even years, maybe even too long to really understand the point of the view of the officers of you're sitting behind a desk and you're making determinations about maybe where I should patrol or when I should patrol it. Especially if you have the buy-in of leadership, and I did at Shawnee, they didn't like that maybe I had the ear of the captain or the major or even the chief, and they wanted to make their own decisions. I found I didn't do everything in my career correctly. I had to learn by making mistakes And one of the mistakes I made was trying to assert that I was correct, that I knew in any way, maybe more than they did, because it wasn't always the case. I wasn't always right. When I was right, I wasn't always right about the tactic. Now, sometimes some of what I did was right and it proved fruitful and we reaped the benefits. But I had to, a few years into working for Shawnee, take a step back. And I listened to my chief, then Larry Larimore, when I was actually talking to him and saying, some of the officers are still really resisting this. They almost resent me. He said, a couple of things, Susan. One is, you're never going to get everyone to buy in. This idea that 100% of the department is going to listen to everything you say and do everything you suggest is almost unreachable. Unattainable. He said, if you get 80% to buy it, most of the people, and then you identify people that are influential within the department. So some of the officers, some of the detectives, some of the commanders that are influential over the other officers, you get them to buy in, people will follow. It's not your job to prove your value or to convince people or to argue. It's your job to do a good job as an analyst, make solid recommendations based on really good analysis, and then get the people in the agency that can influence on board. He said, you know, you're going to have 10%. They're absolutely going to love what you do and buy into it fully and follow you. You're going to have about maybe 60 or 70% that, yeah, they take some of what you want and some of what you give, and they use some of that, not all of it, but they use some of it that's useful to them. And you're going to have 10 or 20% that have no use for you. And that's okay. So how did I get buy-in? It was a struggle. I've been to agencies across the United States where they hired somebody that was already within the department and very well liked, and people followed them immediately. And I've talked to analysts that still struggled to get that buy-in. The key is to understand the culture of that department. Who are the influencers? What can you offer them? And how can you get them to follow? If not you directly, follow others that are influential in your department.
Interesting. I thought of Pareto's principle when you were mentioning that, you know, probably 20% of the folks were 80% of your work.
Absolutely.
The advice I usually give is start from one, get one success and snowball from there, and try to do that in small steps instead of trying to take on a whole unit or a whole department at once.
I think that's really good advice. It is important. You're not going to walk in and immediately win over everyone. You may be the smartest crime analyst that ever existed. You may be the most personable person that ever existed, but you really have to look at it overall and get to know the department and get to know the personalities and find the opportunities to have some small wins. You don't usually walk into a department and the next week you're solving a major homicide series. That's not usually how it works.
I find it interesting that you went from a larger agency to a smaller agency. What went into making that decision, going from larger to smaller?
Yeah, well, at Overland Park, which was about three times the size, Jerry Tallman was the manager, and we were expanding rapidly. Jamie May and Melissa Powell, who I believe leads the unit still now, and others had joined. And so we became quite a large unit. It was at that time that both Jerry and I became very involved in the IACA and started making names for ourselves outside of just Overland Park. But what Shawnee offered me, I was actually sought out by the then chief, Charlie Clark, who said, we don't have a crime analysis capability at Shawnee, and we're a growing department. We'd like you to come set up and lead and eventually expand the department at Shawnee. So what it offered me was a managerial or a lead role and the opportunity to set up my own unit at Shawnee and be able to design it how I'd like. So the reason from going larger to smaller was going from one on a team to leading, establishing, and moving forward in my career.
And as you've progressed through this time, technology takes off, right? So it's like you said in the beginning, you were doing stuff in Excel, you were doing paper reports, but then what were some things that you implemented to start automating and helping your fellow analysts in your unit?
That's a great question. And yeah, because I was in the field so long and because technology was moving so fast at that time and still does, it was important for us to start moving to that kind of automation. Believe it or not, our first crime analysis database was in Foxborough. I doubt many of your listeners are going to remember Foxborough, but yeah. Riley Spoon, who was one of the most influential people in my career early on, had introduced me. I went to an IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police, crime analysis class in El Paso, Texas. about 2 years, maybe a year and a half, 2 years into my career. And I met Riley Spoon, who was the instructor for it. And I went to a second class in Las Vegas and Nevada with Riley as well, that was like Fox Pro 2, and came back and I said, we need to move from putting these in Excel, which really isn't a database, spreadsheets, into an actual database that we could start querying. So, well, let's put all the data in. And then when the chief comes to us and says, I want to know how many vehicles were stolen where they were unlocked and left running to warm up in the morning during this time period, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. And then again, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. in commercial lots. So in the morning, they were at residences. In the afternoon, they warmed up in commercial lots. And so Jerry and I worked really hard to move things into Fox Pro. And that was our first experience with having a database we could query. I also remember when ArcGIS became a thing. And I remember how cumbersome it was, but how impressed people were. And we got our first plotter and we could make these gigantic district maps. We could make a map of the last 30 days of auto, what we called auto burglaries, people call auto break-ins, stolen autos, residential burglaries, commercial burglaries, and robberies. And Jerry led this, but this is how I progressed in technology, is we started working directly with our IT department, our information technology department at City of Overland Park. And we worked with a couple of really talented people that were very forward thinking. That was the first automation. We moved from these paper reports to getting them electronically. So they'd be entered into the computer and we started being able to access the RMS system and the CAD system, and we'd get downloads and they'd go into Fox Pro, later Access, later other systems, and we could export data to create automated crime maps, we called them at that time. And these were a snapshot, a glimpse. They weren't live like we later did. And we would print these maps on the plotter, not one map on this great big thing, but all those different maps with different symbols. And we put them in the patrol rooms. We would share them with other agencies when we went to crime meetings, and we would give them copies of them. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a snapshot. That was the technology at that time. Fast forward to kind of when I culmination of my crime analysis career, which is now 7 years ago. That blows my mind because I really still feel like who I am, what defined me, despite what I do now. I was an analyst. I found patterns. I discovered trends. I relayed information. I made forecasts. I did these things. That was really who I was in the majority of my career. But when I was at the end of my career, we had moved to crime bulletins were no longer this thing where you just summarize little bits and pieces of every report that came in. That just wasn't useful. We got to where things were timely to a specific audience, whether it was some kind of GIS product or some kind of BOLO alert, or quite frankly, an electronic bulletin, and targeting via using the computer and the technology, sending things to mobile data terminals, mobile data computers, doing electronic briefings and the sort. So it went a long way during the time, those 17 years, really, I was an analyst, from stacks of paper and going through them and manually entering them to, at the end of my career, automated downloads of certain types of information into certain databases that we performed automated timed queries to give us the information we needed to, as real time as possible, get that to targeted audiences. Everybody in my department didn't need everything I produced. So that was probably the most significant change as an analyst in my career, was leveraging the technology to get to the point that I was giving the right customer the right analysis and information at the right time that they could action on.
Yeah. I laugh with the idea of plotters, because for as much as they were used at the time that you're talking about, they're almost obsolete today.
You know, Jason, I laughed at when we had plotters when we had them, because yes, the most useful thing we did were these large scale maps. They made the news. People came in and had to blur them out and whatnot, but you know, like blur out where the incidents were, but the news came in because that was so state of the art. And here we had hanging in roll call, the officers could look at like my jurisdiction, you know, my territory, my district, whatever you call that smallest patrol area, for the officers getting slammed with whatever. But it didn't really give them information about what to do. And Jason, I think I had more requests for happy birthday banners. And could you please print out targets? We're going to do a culling of the deer. Again, we're in Kansas. So we do deer culling to control population once a year. And they wanted to practice. So they had me print deer heads at a certain realistic size of what a deer head was at different angles, you know, on the plotter to use for preparation for that. I mean, target it was practice. More misused than used.
That's funny. It definitely was used as preparation for a party. I think everybody did that.
Definitely. Everyone I knew did that. And that was kind of the running joke at the time. And you're right. Is there a time and a place somebody might need to produce something? Sure. You're going to a city event or some kind of governmental meeting, and you need to show something at a, level that the audience can understand. Sure. But for the most part, we've moved past that era.
As you come into this Shawnee position and you're creating this unit and getting it off the ground, when you think back, what is some things that stand out, maybe things that worked or some things that didn't work?
When I was setting up the unit at Shawnee, one of the things that was most important to me that worked and I advocated for and continue, I still have contact with a lot of analysts and students, and we can talk about that later, but students in the field. And one of the things that worked was I immediately started recruiting unpaid interns and volunteers. I was, of course, of no authority or at any level, nor could Shawnee justify a second crime analyst, but there was more work than it could be done in 40 hours by just me. And I also wanted the opportunity that had been afforded to me by others and that I was copying from Overland Park Police Department to bring in people that were interested in becoming a crime analyst or in school and an undergraduate or graduate degree that wanted some real life experience. And so I heavily recruited and got the word out, and sometimes I'd have somebody that was a detective's young adult child who was going to school to become a police officer or interested in criminology. They would say, hey, would you take them on as an intern or a volunteer? And so I had one of the most active units, probably at least in the Midwest, with at one time 7 interns and volunteers supporting. So I would train them on how we did different kinds of analysis, how we looked at different kinds of crime, how we did problem solving. They assisted me on my largest problem solving project at Shawnee, which was Rusty's Last Chance Saloon, which went on to be published by NIJ and featured at several conferences. That wasn't just the work I did. That was the work people like Josie Villa, Kyle Stoker, Sabrina Potts, and Adrian Milkey, and others did to support my efforts. So I'd say one of the things that I did that I'm most proud of was from the very start, I engaged others that had the passion, interest, desire, and the time to assist me in building a unit that was beyond the capabilities of one person, because I was only one person, and leveraged their skills, their thoughts, their ideas, their input, which became more and more in depth as they became more and more experienced in the area. And now all those people I named and more have gone on to have very successful careers in crime analysis themselves.
As you're bringing in these volunteers and interns, were you able to get them all equipment?
Yeah, so interestingly, my office when I first started at Shawnee Police, not unlike many others, we were going into an extremely old, outdated building, and it only had room for 2 people. So we made a schedule. I got a second computer. We shared the printer. We shared the plotter. But they had everything on their computer that I had, and this was desktop computers at that time. And there was only room for the volunteer and I, or the intern and I. So we made a schedule for the volunteers so that they didn't overlap, and they all had the same generic username and password to access the system. However, about 4 years into that at Shawnee Police Department built a new public safety center. And I advocated to the deputy chief, Jim Morgan, who later became the chief, and Charlie Clark, who was the then chief and now is retired, and Larry Larimore, again, who also later became a chief. He was a major at the time, that I needed a larger office. And so when they designed it, the new building, my office ended up being more square feet than the chief's office. Didn't have a window, so it wasn't quite as good, but I did have my area, room for the plotter, room for all the books we had, because we had all the books coming out from NIJ and Pop Center and people that were writing on it, Steve Gottlieb's books, Mark Stallo's books, by people like Derek Paulson, Brian Hill, and all the publications from CMAP with Sean Baird, Dan Helms, and others. Everybody that was writing on it at the time And then also we had three stations where the crime analysts, volunteers, and interns could come and sit at them and do their work. So I had a huge office. I was very lucky that I had that buy-in. So I had my desk in my area. And quite frankly, it got to be when I was traveling, when I was sick, or when I was on vacation, the analysts were so talented, they just sit at my desk. They would access directly my folders and produce things from my spot. They became so well known, not in our agency, but outside our agency, that they started attending outside crime analysis meetings, MARCAN and detective meetings and whatnot on my behalf. So I never limited what they could do or who they could talk to. I never tried to put a cap on it. If anything, I tried to be as transparent and enabling and really make them fully recognize as crime analysts looking for a job. They had all the access I did. So I was really lucky. Second part of my career at Shawnee for the command staff to buy in and to give me the space and the technology and the licenses and the computers.
When I had Kyle Stoker on the show, he talked about his experience, his time volunteering and interning with you. He echoed that sentiment. Let's get into your badge stories. And when we were talking the other day during the prep call, you mentioned that you have two. And for those that may be new to the show, the badge story is the career-defining moment case for analysts. So your first one, you name it the banana guy. So let's talk about the banana guy.
Yeah. So the banana guy is a story of a sex offender. And, you know, amongst us adults here, the banana represents what you would think on an adult sex of male sex offender. This man was, his name's Mr. Ward. And ultimately, he was the first person convicted as a sex offender and deemed a sex offender without ever having actually touched a child or anyone, another person. A really interesting story. It happened after I started at Shawnee. So of course I'd had some small wins at Overland Park under Jerry Tallman. I'd had one win there called Close the Door on Crime that later was featured at an NIJ conference. That it was a big milestone in my career. But when I got to Shawnee and I was setting up my own unit, I met then Sergeant Dan Tennis, who now I believe is a major at Shawnee Police Department. Dan was somebody that bought into crime analysis. When I talk about finding your champions, he saw the role, he saw the use, and he did embrace me into his world. He led the detectives and he was the person's detective. So he was over homicides and sex offenses and robberies. And he said, "You're new here, but we've had something happen in the last month and I think you'd be interested in it." This is back in the day, Jason, when very few people had cell phones yet. There were home answering services and the caller IDs were starting to be a thing on people's home answering machines. And he says to me one day, "We have had two instances where a young female has been home alone after school. They're happening around 3:30 or 4. And they get a really strange phone call from a man who says, 'I'm with the Kansas City Star,' or 'I'm doing an article for the Kansas City Times,' which the Times doesn't exist anymore, or something like that. And he says, 'Are you so-and-so?'" He names them by name. And the child would be caught off guard and be like, "Yes, I am." Again, these are young. They're all female, 11 and 12 year old, prepubescent. He would say, "I want to interview you. Is your mom or dad home?" And they would say, "No." Never was the parent home. And that was part of the mystery. How did he know there was no parent home? He would then proceed to start to interview them. "I understand you go to Miss Maria's dance studio, or you go to this gymnastics location, this gymnastics club, that you're very well involved in this. Is that true?" And of course, the child buys into this. "Yes, I do go to that dance studio. I am in gymnastics." He would lure them in. And he would talk to them for 5 or 10 minutes, interviewing them. The child felt no threat, no harm. They weren't put on guard. But about 10 minutes into the call, the offender, Mr. Ward, would suddenly change his tone, become very serious, and would threaten them with very specific language and threaten them if they hung up the phone and name their parents and siblings and even sometimes kind of where they live or what school they went to, and threaten them they could not hang up the phone. And then would in graphic detail call himself, "I'm the banana guy, and this is what I'm going to do to you." These children were mortified. Obviously, at this age, they did not know this kind of language, what they kind of figured it out. Terrified, they'd usually hang up and call their parents who would come rushing home, and they would look at the caller ID and they'd call the police department. The pattern was identical each time. Dan Tennis had told me, "I think Aletha has had one of these as well. maybe you reach out and talk to Olathe. They had crime analysts that were police officers at the time. So we reached out and they said, yeah, we've had one. And also another jurisdiction they'd name had one. And then I called that jurisdiction. They go, I think this other jurisdiction's had one. So I started gathering. I had them fax me copies of all the reports and I started putting it all together. Now, this was different, Jason, because it wasn't all within our own agency where the data was coming into my database. This was gathering information from other agencies, and I had to do it manually still at this time. I started analyzing the pattern. Fast forward about 2 or 3 days, I had a list of nine over five agencies. I could see the pattern. I could see his most frequent day of the week. I could see the numbers he was calling from. And this was back when you did something called crisscross phone numbers. Only really data analysts are going to remember crisscross. We found out that they were coming from a Quick Trip, which is a convenience store, like 7-Eleven,
okay,
right on our border of Shawnee and Kansas City, Kansas, from a phone bank of payphones. The detective and I got permission, and in a kind of a awesome turn of events, I was permitted, because of course I'm not a police officer, to go on what you might call a stakeout. That might be a little much, but we basically went one Thursday afternoon during the time that I thought the offender would hit. We sat back on this bank of payphones and just watched. And the time I thought he was going to hit came and went. And we were a little disappointed because we didn't see anybody. So the detective had gone into the Quick Trip to talk to the clerk and say, you know, have you seen anybody, especially on Tuesdays and Thursdays during this time? Does anything stand out? Well, again, this is pre-cell phones, so I'm still sitting in the car. And lo and behold, this pickup truck, this old pickup truck, pulls up in front of the phone banks. And of course, I sit up and I'm staring and I'm fascinated because I'm like, is this the person? And this man, this white male, gets out of the truck and he goes over and he kind of lingers around these payphones. And then he actually goes back to his truck. He doesn't make a call. He goes back to his truck. He moves his chair. I could see the whole bench seat sliding back and smokes a cigarette, staring at this bank of phones. The detective comes out and gets in the car and I'm just all bubbling like, that's him. That's him. It's my gut. I know that's him. And the sergeant says, you know what? I think you're right. And copies down the license plate number on the vehicle. We start taking a description. Again, predating cell phones. We're not able to take pictures or anything. But the man backs up and the detective calls it in and says, we're going to follow this vehicle. Gives him the license plate. And the dispatcher comes back and basically says, that person lives across the street. And he literally went across the street and parked his truck. Of course, the detective has a lot more experience than me and says, this is him. Gathers all the information he can, watches him walk into the house. Fast forward, they get a search warrant. They do what's called trash him. They went that night and picked up trash that had been put out. That's actually his sister's house. In the trash, they find the programs to performances at the gymnastics place in Miss Maria's dance studio and other similar locations. What he had been doing was he was going to Miss Maria's or Kansas Dance and Cheer or other places, and he was finding out when their performances were and then posing as a parent, videotaping these young girls, seeing who their parents were, reading the programs. He would pick people with unique last names. He was never picking a Jones or a Johnson or a Smith because he would look them up in the phone book.
Sure.
And it would say Kathy and Tom Smith at this address, this phone number, Kathy and Tom, unique last name, Whitford or whatever, something more unique. And so he knew the parents' names. Sometimes it listed siblings that had pictures of the children. He looked them up in the phone book. There's their address. And he would call after school when the child was home alone. He never videoed any of the children's faces, just from the neck down. They recovered hundreds of hours of video. We were able to tie him to all the cases we had and many, many more. He is still in custody because he is still considered a threat to children. He is in custody in a mental hospital. So that was one of the most pivotal, most rewarding experiences around a single, series I ever had and still sticks with me to this day.
That is really good work, though. That is fantastic as an analyst, being there at the scene, having your forecast, and to have you be in the right place at the right time.
It was amazing. And, you know, something I tell new analysts is like, this isn't going to happen all the time. Your forecasts, your predictions, they don't always. This one happened to pan out, but in a span of 17 years, I have a handful of times where something worked out perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I tell analysts, don't expect it to always be this TV worthy, you know, situation, but you will feel the reward of the times it does happen that inspires you, that carries you to the next.
It also gets me thinking just of the time period in the 90s and even the early 2000s. During this time, there was this concept of latchkey kids, kids that came home from school and would be home alone until their parents came home at 5 or 6 o'clock. And that's exactly when these incidents were occurring. And it's just something that it just, you don't hear that concept too much nowadays, this latchkey kid or kids being home alone after school.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with this year with COVID, it seems mm-hmm. like everybody's at home. So, but at that time period, you know, it was the caller ID. Everybody was giving us the same bank of phone numbers. It was after school. It was almost always Tuesday, Thursday. We would have repeat victims where they would try to call again. If he called and the child said, yes, my parent is here, he hung up. And it turned out, as a really sad piece of this, he was also a substitute middle school teacher.
Yeah. Oh. All right. Well, so now let's get on to your second story. So we go from the banana guy to the screwdriver bandit. And I give you great props for coming up with clever names for these folks.
They kind of evolve. You keep talking about me. You know, our screwdriver bandit guy. This is a shorter story, but this was a good example of interagency cooperation. So intra-agency being within your own agency, inter, you know, Shawnee was right next to Overland Park, right next to Lenexa, Leawood, Mission, Marion, Prairieville, Olathe. So all these cities border each other. So we very often shared crime series. And in this case, the screwdriver bandit originated in Kansas City, Kansas, which again, I mentioned earlier, Shawnee shared a border with. Now, the person that was arrested eventually and convicted was Lonnie Christopher Bond. He went by Chris Bond. And he actually had no criminal history. He came from a home where his parents were still married. They didn't live in poverty. He had a good education. He was working, installing high-end equipment into cars for people, customized stereos and ground effects and things like that. But he met a girl. Always is that kind of story. He met a girl, and unfortunately, by day, she seemed good, and then she was getting deeper and deeper into drugs. He had a baby, who later a toddler, during the course of these events that was not Chris Bond's child, but they lived together. So he, the girlfriend, the drug problem, and her child. When the girlfriend, whom he loved immensely, and he wanted her to get off drugs. He wanted to help her. But when she would be coming down from a high or taking excessive drugs, she would become violent and hurt the child. And Lonnie Christopher Bond, to the degree that we ever sympathize with a criminal, because he is a criminal and he did do crimes, was trying to protect the child and would take the child and try to go places and keep her away while the mom came down off of the drugs. But eventually, she started hurting him. And so the story goes that we later discovered that she introduced him to her Uncle Gary. Interestingly, we never identified Uncle Gary, even though we got very specific information about him. We worked for more than a year to try to identify him and never could. But the first crime occurred. These are all robberies of places like Little Caesar Pizzas, little gas stations with only like a clerk on duty, little corner stores that were targeted. The first robbery that Chris Bond said he did was with this mysterious Uncle Gary, and it was in Kansas City, Kansas. And Uncle Gary was in a stolen car and had Chris with him and said, I'm going to show you how to rob places. These people never catch anyone. Took him into a small corner gas station and just said, here, and threw him a screwdriver. So Uncle Gary had a knife and Chris Bond had a screwdriver that he buried in his pocket. And they went in and he said, give me all your money, get down on the floor, or we're going to stab you. Don't push the button. You know, just give us the money. Mm-hmm. And they covered up their faces and everything. And so that was the first one. He was taught how to rob, if you will. And he brought back whatever the money was and gave it to the girlfriend, and she went and bought drugs with it. Well, this led to Chris doing them on his own. He would just steal a car close to the house, the apartment they shared, and then go to a similar type of Target and go in and go, give me all your money. Don't push the button. Sometimes he'd say, go to the back room. He was pretty consistent, but he would just rob them. And he was only getting $70, $80, $100 each time. Mm-hmm. And he never hurt anybody. And he always had a screwdriver in his pocket pointed. So they couldn't tell. Was it a gun? Was it a knife? What was it? There was just something in his pocket. He always covered his face the same way. The description of the suspect, case to case to case, was identical. The words he used, the targets he selected, the stolen auto. We were always getting these different cars because it was always a stolen auto. Again, Uncle Gary showed him what cars to steal. He always stole Hondas. That's what he knew how to hotwire and get going. But what was really interesting was the tempo of the crimes. So anybody that's ever had a Sean Bear class, a Dan Helms class, when you talk tactical, you talk tempo. Is it steady? How much do they get? Is it increasing in frequency? Is it decreasing? Is it spreading out? Are you missing incidents? When I brought all the incidents together, I could see that the frequency went from 3 or 4 days apart to 2 or 3, to it every other day, to every day, to the point that one weekend, I couldn't even leave the police department because he was hitting every 5 to 6 hours.
Oh, wow.
I was live timing, if you will, getting the information, adding it in, making the next forecast. And he was circling a major corridor, major highway, 435 highway around the Kansas City metropolitan area. So we got to where we could predict it's going to be in 5 hours. It's going to be in this area. You know, here's 8 targets in that area. And I was putting these bulletins out all weekend. Again, this was back when there were bulletins. One of the people that received the bulletin was a patrol officer in Leawood, Kansas. His patrol area was the 435 exit to state line in from Leawood into Kansas City, Missouri. And he was sitting alongside the road. The most recent stolen vehicle description and the description of Lonnie Christopher Bond and the forecast. And lo and behold, here he comes. He calls it in. I've got him. He chases him. Chris Bond crashes the car and there's a foot chase and the officer tackles him and literally says, do you have any weapons on you? And Chris Bond goes, only a screwdriver. And they knew that they had him. And so it was amazing. So I got the call at home. We caught him. And he was convicted on him. He never took any drugs himself. The money was always just her increasing drug habit and his desire to pacify his drug addict girlfriend and protect the baby. Very interesting story.
So, and maybe I just didn't follow it there. So how did the officer know that it was him?
Because included in my real-time bulletins I was putting out, there were bolos. Mm-hmm. We knew the most recent stolen car, what it was, the license plate number, because he had used it in the last one and that he still had it. It hadn't been recovered. And of course, we knew the description of the offender. White male, 5'10", curly brown hair. Like we were getting pretty specific. We didn't know his name. We sure could describe what he looked like, what his MO, where he was going to be, when, and in what car. So he knew it.
So
it was also 4 o'clock in the morning. There's not a lot of traffic out.
Oh, there you go. And so what did he normally do with the cars when he was done? Did he just dump them?
Yeah, he would dump them, but he would always steal another Honda. So as soon as another Honda was stolen, he knew what car he was in because he only knew how to steal one kind of car.
That's an interesting case. Definitely understand why you called him the screwdriver bandit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a break. After the break, what I want to talk about is your influence over the law enforcement analysis profession and get into a little bit with the IACA, your work there, and get into some advice that you have for our audience.
Great.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Stacey Belladin. As an aspiring crime analyst, I tried to find any training available to learn. Learn from classes, workshops, conferences, networking, you named it. If I could give one piece of advice, it is to invest in your future. I see many analysts sit out of training not to go to important conferences because their agency won't pay for it. And that happened to me too, but there's nothing that says you can't figure out how to get there on your own. Submit a presentation on your work, and you may find that some conferences will waive your registration. Buddy up in a hotel room to cut costs. Find local opportunities on online training where you don't have travel costs. Just like you budget for a vacation or a child's education, you should do the same for your continuing education. It's worth it.
So this is Sam, and I want to let you know that it's okay to talk to strangers. Obviously not if you are 4 or if you're walking alone at night or in the woods. But in general, if you're just out in your day-to-day life or you're traveling or whatever, talk to somebody, talk to strangers. It makes you a more interesting person because it gives you more perspective on life. Everyone is walking around with an interesting story. So many people will defy your expectations when you see someone and you make certain assumptions about them, whether they're conscious or unconscious. I love the moment when you realize you were wrong. It's a great feeling, and I think it makes your life richer in general. You know, if you're too shy, then maybe just read Humans of New York. That might help you to understand other people's experiences. But I'm just here to say, don't not talk to strangers.
Welcome back. Now, Susan, what I want to get into is your influence over the law enforcement analysis profession. You kind of alluded to it in the first segment there when you talked about branching out, having an internship program, having a volunteer program, establishing MARCAND, working with the IACA, teaching. When you think back, what do you think your legacy is?
If I were to hope of what my legacy would be, what people would remember me for, was in my career early on, there were some key people that opened doors for me. People like I mentioned Riley Spoon, Noah Fritz, Ron Baer and Dan Helms, Jerry Tallman, Ron Wilson at NIJ, maybe not well known in the crime analysis field, but at NIJ, he was advocating. The CMAP program, the MAPS program at NIJ, Ronna Sampson and Mike Scott, Mark Stallo, Steve Gottlieb. There are really so many, and many of these people are people you have featured. As I was looking through and preparing for this podcast, I looked at who you've been interviewing. And I think so many of these people are people that had such a big influence on my career. But a select few, like Mark Stallo and Noah Fritz and Chris Bruce and Riley Spoon and others, they opened doors for me. Riley Spoon gave me the opportunity to be the IACP's crime analysis expert, which led to me getting to present at IACP conferences at an international level, presenting to hundreds of chiefs of police in multiple languages. Ron Wilson got me in at NIJ, which led to me becoming a subject matter expert and led to publications and influence in that area. My accomplishments aside, what's important to me is that I did for others what others did for me. That these people gave me opportunities. They saw that I was eager and they said, how about this? Susan, would you like to go to China and present on this? Said Ron Wilson. Riley Spoon, would you like to be the IACP instructor? Mark Stallo, would you like to deliver classes with me? Noah Fritz, I can't even tell you the number of doors Noah opened, the people he introduced me to, Mike Scott and Ronna Sampson and Herman Goldstein and just all these people that they introduced me to. And what I wanted to do in my career was do that for others, open doors for them, never ignore the analyst that walks up to me that I've never seen before, I don't know, at a crime analysis conference or at a police department event or at anything and says, I want to be like you, or I've heard of you, or I did this like you. I wanted to bring everyone I could under my wing and help them to achieve their goals in their department. That's why I felt so passionate about interns and volunteers and helping agencies that were trying to set up new crime analysis capabilities like Rapid City, South Dakota, or Fort Smith, Arkansas, or places in California or Florida. As they were setting them up, I was passionate about trying to help them, trying to identify the right person for that agency to go far. And so more than anything, I hope my legacy is that I was grateful to all the people that opened doors for me and that I did my best in the areas I was influential, whether it was the IACA or MARCAND or teaching at colleges and universities where I've had hundreds of crime analysis students. I helped them open doors for them to achieve their goals as well.
When we had Noah Fritz on the show, we talked about his analyst tree, and he described something very similar to what you're describing. Yes, there was folks that helped him along, but he was most proud of the fact that there were so many that he passed the torch to, for lack of better terms, and influenced over their career. Same thing with you. We didn't get into some of the numbers. When you've been teaching for 2 decades, help develop 20 to 30 analytical units. training, curriculum developing. There's a lot that you have done that it's probably going to be difficult to really capture in this podcast. For those that maybe not know you, I guess, how did you do it kind of thing? So, because it's easy to say, but then when you talk about opening doors for all these people, like you mentioned, you had 7 volunteers at one point in time. I mean, that's no small feat. So how did you go about opening all these doors for so many people?
You know, at one point, people used to say it's not who you know, it's what you know. And I think what you know is incredibly important. You need the education, you need time in, experience, and things like that. But in the field of crime analysis, there is a lot of value to who you know. When I talk about opening up doors to people, sometimes it's listening to what they're trying to achieve and telling them about the resources that are available. When they tell you, these are things I've not been able to overcome, giving them feedback on how maybe you overcame them. Mm-hmm. I don't know the number of analysts that came to me, hundreds maybe, and said, I can't get approval to come to the IACA conference, or regionally, I can't get approval to come to the Marking conference. And I would help them get creative. I would tell them all the tricks and tips I had for how I got to conferences. I submitted to present. I submitted to be on a committee. I used airfare miles to get there. I would tell them I would come back and do a presentation if somebody would support me or sponsor me or explain the value. So sometimes it's based on the experience I had of overcoming obstacles that new analysts or people who wanted to be analysts were facing. Helping them prepare for interviews was a huge thing. I did a thing for the IACA that I think stayed up for a while. I don't think it's up anymore, but that was how to get hired as a crime analyst. What do you need to prepare? What sets you apart from 50 other people applying for that position? What do you need to do? What did you bring? What extra things help prepare you? So when I talk about, I want to be an inspiration, I want to open doors, I want to be a resource. When I would come to know any analyst that said, these are the obstacles I'm facing, I help them come up with ways to overcome the obstacles, whether it was getting to a conference or getting buy-in from the chief or getting a volunteer unit established, I tried to give them insight into what either I or people that I was close to that experienced similar problems did. And then in terms of opening doors, they would say things like, how do you get to go to all these conferences? How do you afford it? How do you get the time off work? Why does your agency let you go on agency time? And I told them the techniques I used, how I explained the value to my agency of my involvement, what I was giving to them. And I would tell the analysts, if you need improvement in GIS skills, here's some free things, here's some online things, here's some people, here's some classes, here's some universities, look at educational reimbursement. So I think, Jason, there's not a one answer of how do you help? How do you inspire? How do you open the doors? It was listening to the problems they were having, sharing and imparting the advice you could give them based on your experience and the experience you knew of others, and helping them overcome those, being a resource to them when they come back a year later and said, this worked, this worked, that didn't work. My chief wants me to do X. I don't know where to start. And I could tell them, okay, this is where you start. And I think that's what a lot of new crime analysts need. They need the wisdom and the experience and someone that's been doing it a long time to take the time, because that's the next generation. So that when I'm 60, 70, 80, sitting in the nursing home someday, I look at the crime analysts of the generation of 2040 and say, you are all amazing. And I remember when I did this and that, and you guys have taken it so much further. I didn't want them to be like me. I wanted them to be better than me. I wanted them to reach higher and go further. I had been in it a long time, moved on to the private sector now, and I'm doing other things. But I don't forget. I don't forget how it felt to be recognized by others. I didn't forget how it felt for someone to open a door, to introduce me to someone that I idolized, that I thought was everything. Like Chris Bruce and Mark Spallo and being friends with Bill Harris and Samantha Gwynn and obviously Noah Fritz. These people that I idolized, I remember being afraid to walk up to Mark Spallo, intimidated by him. And later he became one of the greatest influences on my early career. That's what I want to do for others. I know because I've been told there are people that admire something I've done or wish they could do something I've done or achieve at that level. And I'm like, you can do that, but you can also do more.
In terms of mentoring, what's usually your advice if someone says, well, I just don't know where I want to go. I don't know what I don't know. I'm just starting with a blank slate. I don't really know what my goal is 1 year, 5 years down the road.
Yeah, so I experience that still today with my college students. So I teach at Tiffin University, which is well known to the ICA and probably most of your listeners. Regis University in Denver, Colorado has a huge crime analysis criminology program with an emphasis in crime analysis. I've taught at a community college, crime analysis, problem solving in crime analysis, and law enforcement, criminal justice ethics, and other classes, and then some others like University of Missouri, Kansas City, and now Baker University. So I have lots of classes going at any given time, and I experience that still to this day. Students that are like, even graduate students, that are like, I'm not even sure what I want to do. I took all these classes. I did an internship. Like, how do I know what I don't know? How do I know what else I need to learn? What can I do to set me apart? And that's similar to what these new analysts experience going into an agency. A lot of analysts are one man or one woman bands. Like, they're one person. They're trying to establish it. My biggest piece of advice is obviously on networking to find out what others know, because that'll help you fill those gaps. So you know X, but when you start talking, you know, via email or on phone calls or others, you go to conferences, you go to other kinds of local events, and you hear other topics, you realize, wow, there's this whole human trafficking thing. You know, have I looked at any reports? Is that going to be at my level at a local jurisdiction? Or is that really going to stay more federal because it's across states and things? What is cutting edge? Obviously, having resources like your ICA and now your podcast and other kinds of resources out there, when you see topics that you recognize, I don't know about, it's your opportunity to explore it. Find out who the top people are in that area. Look for the names that come up over and over and reach out to them. Now, there's reaching out to them and then there's pestering people. You don't want to go that far. You don't want to start writing everyone you've ever met and everything. I learned that really from Mark Stallo. He's like, it's okay to reach out to people that are authorities. That's how I found Ronna Sampson, who introduced me to Mike Scott, who introduced me to Herman Goldstein. You know, and when I met Herman Goldstein and I'm sitting with him at a table, well, he's a celebrity in our field. People came up to him. So it was Steve Gottlieb. People come up to him. So I had the benefit of getting to meet these other people too. And that's how I expanded my network. Another person that I hadn't mentioned that I should mention several times though, Rachel Boba Santos. I use her books. I've assisted her. I've reviewed some of the things she's asked me to review. And she has been a huge sounding board and influence in my career and mentor. And I don't reach out to Rachel all the time. I might go weeks, months, or a year. But when I know what a topic she's a subject matter expert in, or I can go to her and say, this is the problem I'm facing. You're someone I know is an expert in this area. She's there for me. There are people that help me be who I am today in other ways by their friendship as a crime analyst, by their experiences. You know, I think of like Stacey Belladin, Chris Jacoby, Tamara Otley. I don't mind at all naming names because I do it because I want the people that listen to your podcast to know that Susan isn't who she is today because I miraculously made this on my own. I needed support, whether it was intellectually or technically, emotionally, the cheerleaders, the people that when I was stuck or I was discouraged that were there for me. It does take the crime analyst, the law enforcement analyst, the public safety analyst, the intelligence analyst, all the people that listen to your podcast, help each other. And then when you do that, they'll be there for you too. And these are people, Mary Craig, Samantha Gwynn, Tamara, I mentioned, Noah Fritz, that when I needed people to support me, were there for me. And it's important to recognize the contributions so many people made. I was in the field a very long time.
Susan, you mentioned interviewing and your advice to folks of how to set them apart in a hiring process. Can you just go over a couple pieces of advice that you usually give to folks during the hiring process?
Absolutely. This is something I feel pretty passionate about. As I said, I actually did a whole presentation on getting hired as a new analyst, the do's and don'ts. And I don't think that it has changed enough for the law enforcement as a whole that this general advice, I think it's still applicable today. when I helped agencies, for instance, Raytown, Missouri is an agency, I sat in on all their interviews to hire and select a crime analyst at their department. And we would get dozens of people that just, they had a bachelor's degree in criminal justice or criminology, and they would make a statement, you know, on their application, I'm interested in becoming a, they would muck up the criminal analysis because they didn't even really know what the position was or whatever. These were just applications that came in of just everybody that graduated with a bachelor's degree in this area that were all fighting for this one position that sounded interesting. They would put statements like, I've always been interested in profiling. And we'd be like, yeah, they don't know what a crime analyst is. I've always been interested in criminal logistics and CSI at the scene. Yeah, they don't know what crime analysis is. So you can weed people out pretty quickly. I would tell people that were my students, and I've always offered to review their resumes before they graduate, or my graduate students as they're applying for jobs, is you want to capture the attention early on of people weeding out people that just are not going to make it to that interview. You want to list things, not just your degree that everyone else has, but within that degree, what were some specialty classes? Use keywords like studying tactical, strategic, administrative, intelligence analysis, courses in predictive analysis. Say things that are specific to this career. Always, always stress and encourage while they're in college, get an internship, even if it's a sacrifice, even if it's unpaid, and not just one at one agency. Get something at the state level, get something at the local level. If you want to go federal, then try to get a federal internship or volunteer and learn about what the people for that agency do. One of the best pieces of advice, if I'm applying to Overland Park, Kansas Police Department, is I want to know everything about Overland Park so that when I get to that interview, I can say, you know, you've been established since 1991, crime analysis unit staffed by a manager and multiple analysts. I know you have a volunteer program. I know the size of the jurisdiction. I know some of the major crime problems. I know that you border these other cities. You want to get into that interview. First, you want the resume and the statement of intent that reflect you know what crime analysis is and that you've been preparing yourself for this specific field. Then when you get to the interview, you want to show you've done research, that you know what this agency is looking for, that you know that the analysts are divided up of property and persons and online or high tech or, you know, whatnot, crime. You want to leverage who you know. You say, it was recommended to me by Major so-and-so at this other police department that I would be a good fit for this position. If that's a true statement, obviously, make it. So, you know, my words of advice are to be prepared through your academic career, but also get real life experience, even if it comes at a sacrifice. You're working full time, you're going to school full time, but get the real world experience. That sets you apart. If you can get a recommendation from where you got that experience and include it, that sets you apart. And if you come to that interview with knowledge about that jurisdiction, crime problems, population, how the unit's set up, or that it's being freshly created, that shows the people interviewing you that you want this enough that you've spent time preparing. You follow all of that, you're 90% the way there. Now it comes down to who's the best candidate.
Good advice. And to the audience, shameless plug here, Sean Bear and I did do 7 podcast episodes on, called it Sean Bear's Guide to Hiring a Law Enforcement Analyst. And you can check that out. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. One of the things we did, Susan, in that series of podcasts is we also talked about the perspective from the hiring manager. So do you, some advice for hiring managers, maybe it's a question that you like to ask or a scenario that you like to present to make sure that the managers are getting the best candidates?
So I think the most important piece of hiring a new crime analyst is knowing what skills you're looking for, where the gaps are in your existing team. Obviously, if you have a specific position you're filling, knowing who that audience is. So if I'm hiring someone that's going to work with the detectives, what is it that the detectives look for as well? It's not always you're looking at a field of candidates and you want the person that's most technically proficient. You may be looking at hiring a position where you need someone that will be quickly accepted by the target group, such as the intelligence analysts or the detectives, or if it's someone for command staff. that they'll buy into them. So one of the things I say is you are not always looking for the person with the best resume. You're looking for the one that has the resume that best fits the need of your agency.
Let's move on to the IACA now. Again, we didn't get into too much of the numbers. And when I first introduced you, you got into the IACA. You were a secretary first for 5 years. You were VP of admin for 4 years. And then you were president for 5 years. And you also spent 7 years as the conference chair. Some of that I went over in the top 10 episode. And certainly there's way more accomplishments that you did over your tenure there. You talked a little bit about it in the first segment of getting introduced to the IACA, but then how did you get involved with different committees? And then how did you run successful elections? What advice do you have for folks on that realm?
The IACA is absolutely a significant part of my life and what influenced me and made me the analyst, the person, both professionally and personally, who I am today. I listened to your top 10 most influential, it's a phenomenal podcast. I thought you did a really great job of a good balance of, it's not, there aren't 10 people that, you know, it was all them, certainly. I love all the honorable mentions. I love listening to the quips and little call outs you did, because it took me back so many years and thinking about the journey that the IACA was for me. So I first got introduced to it. I mentioned Mark Stallo before, and between elections, the secretary position on the board became vacant. And at that time, the president could simply select and the board ratify the selection of the president, which was Mark Stallo, to fill the remainder of that person's tenure, the opening. And so he asked me, because I had expressed such an interest of moving my career forward at such an early point. I'd only been an analyst a couple of years at that point. I think this is 1999. I might be off a year or two, but it was 1999. He asked me, would you be interested? And I was just over the moon, because I actually was going to, before I decided to get in law enforcement, I was going to be a journalist. Mm. And he said, one of the things that come along with secretary is a lot of writing and writing the newsletter and taking the notes and all that stuff. And I was like, I love it. I can type so fast and I'll get to hear what's going on. And you know, I love it. I didn't really know what I was getting into. So I got onto the board and I loved the meetings and once a month, telephonic meetings. And I love this is email was starting to be a thing. And there was an upcoming conference. And I said, can I be part of the, I'd have to think back, but I think speakers committee was the one I asked to be part of first and help pick people to fill the schedule. And then I said, can I actually make the schedule? And then I said, okay, can I actually introduce some of the people? And it was really me asking early on, I want to do this. I want to do that. I know a lot of people, even some of your listeners, but you know, we always hear the top fear is public speaking. You know, I'm afraid of a lot of other things like snakes and spiders and things like that. But I've never had any problem getting up and speaking in front of people. It's actually kind of where the real me comes out. I love it. Because so many other people did not want to do these roles, they were eager for me to, yeah, you can introduce people. Yeah, you can do these remarks. Yeah, you can run this meeting or whatever. And so I just kept volunteering to do everything no one else wanted to do. I started just being like, I love this. I love this. I love the conference. Jason, in your podcast, I listened to, you know, you're talking about like a family reunion and how the IACA mm-hmm. becomes your family for better or for worse, because there's mostly ups and there could be disagreements and there could be people taking sides or whatnot. But really overall, the IACA became your crime analysis family in a field where sometimes or almost always you are the only analyst in your agency. Mm-hmm. And there may or may not be a regional group. And this was your one time, once a year, to go and meet with like-minded people and to do the nights out and get to know people that have the same passion you have, to talk to somebody about a problem-solving project you're doing mm-hmm. where no one at your police department's really listening. You know, you might have the ears of a couple people, but something you felt really passionate about. To meet people, you know, when you were talking about the different speakers brought in and keynotes and all the different areas, you got to meet people you'd only heard about. You were having dinner with these people that you'd only heard about, and they're sitting mm-hmm. at your table yeah. and they're saying hello to you. Mm-hmm. So Jason, it does become your family for better or for worse. The conference, especially, you know, the first 10, 15 years of it, you know, this was like the event you look forward to more than anything else each year. It was about what you could learn, but it was also about who you could meet and the new things you would hear, the latest technology, and you could meet with the vendors and see what Esri's technology is or the Microsoft technology and things like that. That's why I was always involved in conferences. And when we grew to the point, it couldn't be a board member also being a conference chair. It was too complex. And people like Mary Kirkwood Burricelli would take over like all the vendors. I mean, she became the vendor person at the conferences and worked hard and had those relationships that we didn't have. And then we had Kyle Stoker with the training and overseeing those topics. And then Mary Craig and Kellen Cassidy and Erica Jackson and others that really became deeply involved. Michelle Kennedy. I'm trying to think of all the people, Samantha Gwynn, that were just staples in the conference committee. And so it got to the point when I became vice president of administration, the conference was kind of in my purview, but I wasn't running it. They were running it. There was an entire team that ran it and the board simply supported it because the logistics became incredible from site selection. In fact, I just noticed they now have a site selection committee because that is quite yes. overwhelming itself. So my passion while I was on the board, I never denied, was greatly into the conference. And then later expanding to the international conferences, the first one in Vancouver. I was so proud of that. I'm so proud of everyone that supported it, both our international prime analysts up in Canada, but also the board and the conference committee for that to be such a success that it was. Moving into Santiago, Chile, which was really established by Chris Bruce, Trinidad and Tobago, which was Chris and Noah, Sean Baer and others that got us into there. That's just spiraled. Sam Steiner over in Europe and Austria led us to the Hague and going over there, it just exploded in this wonderful way that we got so much momentum. And it wasn't Susan that was doing it, it was us. It was all of us and all of our contacts and our international members that would raise their hand and say, come here, we've got a core group. Please come here and help us launch this in our areas that have led to where it's at today with all kinds of international events. We had the first international symposium. We had first international committee. We expanded, I think I was either vice president of administration or president. We added the colleges and universities committee, the white papers committee. We expanded training immensely. That started out with just a few classes where I wrote the curriculums, 5 classes to what it is today under Kyle Stoker and others. So I was lucky. My timing of coming on as secretary under a really strong board, that was Dale Harris, Mark Stallo, Noah Fritz, Chris Bruce, and others, Chris Gebhardt, Judy Kimenow, Lori Frank, they established and they went through the struggles where they were paying out of pocket for things and waiting to make enough money to be reimbursed, putting things on their personal credit cards. Came in at the time it was really getting its feet beneath it and expanding. People were interested and eager. It was a great time for me to be part of something where the ball was rolling. I didn't establish the IEC. I wasn't one of the founding members. I grabbed onto the coattails of many greats and listened to what the analysts said they needed. They needed a resource center, tools to use. They needed regional conferences. They needed opportunities. They needed hiring guides. They needed white papers, best practices, liaison with colleges, international opportunities. And I was one of other people that helped create these committees to enable these things to happen. That's what I was most proud of in terms of the IECA, the tremendous support, camaraderie. And Jason, you're right. It's a family. Those people were all there to support each other because we all wanted to be successful.
You know, you said you're lucky. And I think of the saying, you create your own luck. Yeah, you might be correct. You were lucky. But I also think of all the opportunities where you looked and said, can I do that? Can I do that? Can I do that? Or you said, okay, where can I find a need, fill a need? Certainly, you built on each step, each volunteer opportunity, each position that you had with the IACA. So I agree that, you know, it's not just you, but I don't want to downplay your influence to the association either, because you worked tremendously to get a lot of these things that you've mentioned accomplished as part of the reason they were successful.
I appreciate that a lot. I do. I remember talking to an upcoming analyst that had said, you know, I want to do what you've done. You know, I said, part of it is you got to have drive and desire and not wait for everything to be handed to you. I've mentioned a couple of times, people opening doors, they open the door, but it's on you to walk through and embrace, to really put your arms around the opportunity and own it and make it yours. You know, there are lots of analysts where I maybe was invited to speak at a conference or something, and I would bring another analyst along with me. And, you know, if female, say you could share my hotel room, I've got points for your flight and everything, and you ask the host, can I bring someone along I'm mentoring? And I did that maybe a couple dozen times. And I would say, I've opened a door for you. Now you network, you go out there, you make the connections. And when you're successful, do the same for others. Jason, I appreciate that. I do believe to some degree you do make your own luck. You've got to have that drive and that passion. And quite frankly, not everyone has to have the level of drive and passion that I have because, you know, I have an awful lot of energy. I'm teased about that relentlessly. Yes. Like, where do you get all this energy? Somebody, is it you? Is that I'm like a bumblebee? Maybe that was Sean Bear in your podcast.
That was Jeff Vandersip.
Jeffrey Vandersip.
Yes.
Oh, he's awesome. He was someone that came in later in my career that I couldn't get enough of him. He was just something. He's really remarkable as well. But, you know, said like as a little bumblebee, because when I was at conferences, you mentioned that there's times when it felt clicky. And I'm not going to deny that. There were times that there were clicks and there may still be. I'm not still actively involved because of my career change, but that's okay. I would go to conferences and I simply walk up on people. If I saw someone standing along a wall or sitting at a table and it was clear to me that person wasn't talking to anyone, I'd go over and sit down and talk to them, get a key word or two of something they're interested in. Oh, you're interested in that? Let me introduce you to Matt Harris. He knows a lot about that. Come on over here. Matt, somebody I'd like you to, I've just met this person. And so I won't be buzzing around. Really isn't how I want to be remembered. But there's a lot of truth to it that I wanted to be approachable and the analyst. I never wanted anyone to think they couldn't walk up to me and say, this is who I am and this is what I hope or this is what I need or this is the obstacle. Because I wanted to be the person that helped them connect and inspire them to continue. But it really does have to be on that person. Again, you make your own luck. Some things were lucky, right place, right time. Mm-hmm. But I got to that place because I had the desire, the drive, and the innovation to be in that place at that MAPS conference, previously CMAP, or at that Pop Center conference, that I wasn't afraid to walk up to Julie Wortel. I wasn't afraid to walk up to these people and say, I know who you are. I know you don't know who I am. I know you're really an expert at this. Could you help me with this? Yeah. Hopefully people do that.
So for somebody that might be considering running for the board, going through the election process, getting on the board, what advice would you have for them?
I would have the advice that, you know, despite me getting on early, I think that was truly luck that I'd met Mark Stallo and that he selected me and everything. But I think that being very well-rounded to the extent you can, even if your expertise is, let's say, in GIS, to know all the other roles. Don't be narrow-minded to think that everybody only wants to talk to you about GIS or about problem solving or about administrative analysis or whatever your niche is. So know beyond your niche is one thing. The second is that if you're getting on the board, you're not doing it for you, you're doing it for them. You're the voice of them. So while you may have an agenda, you may have passions in certain areas, you may hope to achieve popularity or resume building or whatever your motivation is, you represent a very large membership. When you're representing everyone, that means you need to listen to what their needs are, what the obstacles, and as every good analyst does, you're looking at patterns. So when I'm hearing from different areas of the country, there's this need or this problem, or I'll give you an example, Jason. When we were on the board, we established the scholarships to the conference and what the criteria were for getting a scholarship of a fully paid ride, if you will, to the ICA conference, because we heard from the membership that no matter what I do, my agency is not going to send me and I have to use a week of vacation and my own money. And I really can't do that. It's expensive. So we established the scholarships. And we were, you know, started at 5 and we tried to grow it. And we started the awards and recognition sector. There was some rewards and recognition, but we expanded it under my presidency, but the whole board made the decision that we wanted to. So when people found out they were getting an award, they could justify to their agency. I mean, you're receiving an award. This looks good for our agency, our department. So they would send them. If you're interested in being a board member, I hope that you're doing it for the right reason, that you want to represent all analysts in that association, that you're willing to give the time necessary to listen to their needs and be part of the change, the innovation. Because what was right for the IACA when I was secretary was not the same. The needs evolved when I was VP admin and changed when I was president. I wouldn't even begin to suggest I could step in at this point and know what is needed with my change in my career. So I would say my advice, I had to put a bottom line on it, is know that it's an enormous commitment. Know that you are going to spend a lot of hours and know that you need to be dedicated to the mission of the IACA and that this is not for you, it's for the development of the profession and the development and support of the analysts.
I know right around your presidency, you changed careers. You went from Shawnee to Bear Analytics. I do remember at that point in time, Bear Analytics was a vendor for the conference for the IACA. The question became to be, should a board member for the IACA also work for a vendor? Is that a conflict of interest? My question for you is, when you were president and working for Bear Analytics, how did you ensure that there was no conflict of interest between when you're acting as president of IACA versus working for Bear Analytics?
Yeah, that was quite the topic at the time and very controversial, undoubtedly. From my position, I'd always been an analyst for the analysts. It wouldn't matter if I worked for Shawnee or I was for Overland Park or if I worked for the National Institute of Justice or I worked for Walmart or I worked for a grocery store. I still saw myself as representing the analysts. Presidents that came before me had both public and private sector careers. Dale Harris, public sector, and then went on to own a business. And well, he was past president. And Mark Stoller with Act Now and Noah Fritz with NLECTC. And all of us dabbled in the private sector. But when being the president, working at Shawnee and then leaving Shawnee to go to Bear Analytics as what was later the vice president of operations, became a controversial topic. This is one of those, Jason, where I was looking at it from my point of view and saying, I'm still Susan. I'm still me. I'm still doing this for you. My daytime job was still involved in analytics, but I also had to understand that people that were members that used competing products or felt passionate about keeping it all public sector, people on the board also had their own reasoning. Even though I didn't share it and I was perplexed by it and I was doing everything I could to keep them separate, fact was I was still Susan. I was still me that had all this love for the analysts and promoting the analysts. And for Bear Analytics, my job that paid the bills, I had a role to play there too. I did what I could to keep them separate. I'm never going to profess that I was perfect at it. I did my very best at the time, but it became apparent and overwhelmingly so that with my new career, it was time to step back and it was time to let the next generation, you know, embrace the board and me to fully move on into what eventually became LexisNexis when they acquired Bear Analytics. And I've taken on the last 7 years, a whole new career that I'm unbelievably happy with the change and the decisions and looking forward to my future to continue in this area. But Jason, I don't know that there is some clear-cut answer or some way that you can say you can only be valuable to the IACA and only be a good board member. And only be this perfect, ideal person if you're in the public sector, because I simply don't believe that's true. I think you could be retired. I think you could be a volunteer at a police department. I think you could be in the private sector. I think you could be in the public sector. The fact is that the fastest growing element in analysis is in the private sector. Walmart hires analysts. John Deere hires analysts. All these Fortune 500 companies are hiring analysts to look for fraud, to look for crimes, to look for internal crimes within their own employees, and they need people that have these skills. So the fastest growing area actually is in the private sector, and there will become a day at which the IACA has to make a decision. Are we an association of analysts dedicated only to the analysis of law enforcement public sector data? Are we an association that represents all people doing analysis? I don't know what that answer is. And I don't think I'll be influential in those decisions, but those are hard topics. I happen to be in either the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time because it became quite a controversy. And I look back and the further away I get from it, the more I see points that those in opposition were making. I understood the conflict in their hearts and their objections. I kept thinking at that time that people saw Susan for Susan and had seen my track record and that it wasn't going to be this big deal that it became. And I was wrong. And I'm okay with that. It was a learning, growing time for the IACA. And both the IACA and I are still successful. So it was a hard time and it was a hard thing for people to go through. And the family became a divided family for a bit. But looking back 7 years later, maybe it was something that was needed and something that someday will be used to address that hard question and to make some hard decisions for the association.
Very good. Thank you. I always compliment people for giving me a real answer and not a fluff answer. So thank you for that real answer. Some of this stuff I know when we talked about in the prep call isn't easy for you to talk about. And sometimes it just makes you too sad to talk about. But I do really appreciate your answer there. So thank you, Susan.
Absolutely.
I guess you mentioned LexisNexis. I was just kind of curious, as director now, what is your current role with LexisNexis?
Yeah. So LexisNexis LexisNexis Risk Solutions is part of a bigger parent company called RELICS. And Risk Solutions is divided up into also several businesses. And I work in the government business, which just means all of our customers that I deal with, that the group I work with deals with, there's about 300 of us, are the government customers. So federal government to state and local, county, the tribal governments and whatnot. That just means all of our customers are also in the public sector. I started out there working, doing some analysis, actually, when they acquired Bayer. They weren't quite sure what to do with all of us analysts because Lexis hadn't had strong analytical capability in the government area. Really, they had Samantha Gwynn, who's still there and doing amazing things. Mary Craig was there at the time in government. She's moved on still within LexisNexis to doing some other stuff. But some names that people on this podcast might know. But I started out as an analyst, and then they put me over the Special Investigations Unit, which is what they wanted to call it, not what I wanted to call it, which were assisting our government customers and analyzing data. So LexisNexis is a big data company. We buy and ingest different kinds of data. We're very highly regulated in our field and huge amounts of layers of security. Basically, what we were doing was, you give us your data, we'll add our data and we'll create a better data set for you. So for instance, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a certain data, we combine it with our public data that we have that's regulated, not public like you can get off the internet, but public records data. We provide them back information that hopefully leads to apprehending offenders or finding missing children or other things. Let's say the Marshal Service has a list of warrants. We can provide them the most recent address somebody's used that's on their most wanted list, because sometimes criminals do things like, sign up for a new credit card or something like that. So we can provide them new addresses, just to give you a couple of examples. So my area works with all federal, state, local, county, tribal areas, and we work in law enforcement, public safety. We work in health and human services, fraud health. So all this stuff that's come out around COVID, all the fraud you hear about, like people taking benefits that aren't there, applying for unemployment. We're helping the states and the federal government have data go through our systems first to try to reduce the amount of fraud, and in the tax and regulatory. So people applying for things like education loans to go to college and stuff, to make sure they're alive and they're real people going to real colleges. So that's just kind of a glimpse of what we do. My actual job now as director is I oversee multiple teams. So our batch team is we take their data with our data, give them a new set of data that we've analyzed and provide them some insight. I oversee an implementation team, which is connecting our systems with their systems and helping them get data out of our systems. And then the last one, the one I'm probably most passionate about in this, like my largest team, is the education and training. I mentioned to you earlier, you brought it up, you know, my passion for, I teach at colleges and universities still. I've always been a big proponent of quality education, quality training. And the biggest team I have, which there are several sub-teams under it, is the training and education team. It goes out into the field, and these are the people coming to maybe some of your listeners, police departments, and actually training them how to use our products to help them in their workflow, how to find criminals, new addresses, find somebody that has a warrant, or, you know, we have a product that helps connect jurisdictions together. That was actually the product that came out of Berry Analytics. It used to be called Attack Raids. Now it's called AVCC. Mm-hmm. And that is one that the contributory database, where police departments at all levels are contributing data to a secure location, and then they can query data. So remember my screwdriver bandit? Oh, he was committing across jurisdictions. With this kind of capability, our agencies that are participating can go in and query across multiple agencies and look for patterns across agencies, access the public records to find matching suspects, do link analysis and the like. So Jason, I'm not 1,000% out of the area of crime analysis. It's still happening, but it's just I'm to the level now where I don't touch it on a daily basis. But the people that work for the people that work for me, they're the ones out there in the field. And now I'm managing them as a director. So I manage managers, really. I love working for the company. I love our mission and what we do, and feel very passionate that I'm in the right place for me, because I still feel like the knowledge I have about data and analysis, whether it's batch or implementations or education, is valuable downstream to my teams. But I'm not out there every day living the life of an analyst, but I'm hoping that the guidance I'm giving my teams helps improve the lives of today's analysts.
Well, our last segment is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guests the last words, and you can promote any idea that you want to, Susan. What are your words to the world?
My words to the world are, don't limit yourself to who you already know or what you already know or what you're already doing. You can always improve, and there are always people that'll help you. My words are, if you can't find someone to help you to get to your goal, you can reach out to me and I will help you find the person that will. You can do this.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But Susan, thank you so much for being on the show, and you be safe.
Thanks, Jason, for this opportunity, and I wish everyone well always.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.